This is like a fantasy game you're playing, where you make up a title and a nickname for yourself and pretend you're fighting a revolution. But the other side of that, Mark, is there were real crimes they committed. There were real people they killed, banks that were robbed, bombings they attempted, a very violent organization where women took a big part in the violence, again, to promote this communist or leftist ideology. Their motto, Mark, death to the fascist insect that preys upon the people. The first kind of headline crime this group committed was the murder of the school superintendent from Oakland, Marcus Foster. Mark, cyanide tip bullets. This is a group of college educated, for the most part, or there were college dropouts. There were people with master's degree. Bill Harris, one of the members, had a master's degree. So these were educated people that joined together to kind of promote this cause. And their targeting of the school superintendent, Marcus Foster, I think it kind of backfired on him.
He was targeted for his support of an ID system for Oakland students.
Famous, famous video, Patty Hearst with a rifle in the lobby of the bank, and they even sent the film out to have lip readers read it and see what she was saying. They rob the bank, they get away with $10,000. Patty Hearst releases a tape recording at some point after that, or I should say the SLA releases a recording of her saying that basically she's a willing participant. Another tape recording, this isn't brainwashing. I haven't been brainwashed. I'm down for the cause. The Chief, Mark Garrett, and after this episode, Mark, I may call you Field Marshal General Chief Mark Garrett.
It's Edie Amin Garrett.
Right, right. Good to see you, buddy. You know, today, this is actually the start of a two-part series that we're going to do. And for the past, 5 years, Mark, we've been hearing about these leftist organizations like Antifa, standing for, I guess, anti-fascism. I guess that's where the name Antifa comes from.
Yeah, how ironic is that? But go ahead.
Right. And you know, people think, I think some people in maybe a generation after ours think that this stuff is new. Over the past year, we've had sit-ins on college campuses. And again, people seem kind of surprised by that. Maybe this younger generation. I thought it was a good opportunity to turn back the clock and talk about a group called the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army of the early 1970s. And keep in mind, you know, I think 1970 was Kent State. So yeah. This idea of protests on college campus, this idea of far left leaning groups, promoting or using kind of violence to promote communism, it's not new. It's something that's been around. I don't know if it's cyclical or what it is, but I thought a good time to go back and remind people of what the early 70s were all about and what was happening in our country in the early 70s.
Yeah.
And kind of do it in two parts for this reason. The first is talking about the Symbionese Liberation Army, SLA, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst and the crimes that this group committed. And by the way, a dozen people. This is a group of a dozen people, and we'll get into their backgrounds and everything in a minute. And then the second part, episode two, an interview with a retired LAPD officer named Al Preciado. And Al won was awarded, I guess is a more appropriate term, the Medal of Valor at LAPD for his role in what came to be known as the SLA shootout in South LA, 54th and Compton. Mm-hmm. Mark, what is that, Southwest? Is that Southwest or 77th or?
Yeah, as far as the division?
Well, just as far as kind of where it's located in South LA too.
Yeah, it's in Compton. And so I guess that would probably be, I think it would be 77th Division for LAPD, okay. But yeah.
A huge shootout. And I think to date, Mark, you would know better than me, but to date, still the largest firefight in terms of rounds fired in the history of the state of California.
As far as I am aware, it was.
Yep. And I mean, our generation, Mark, more our generation, you and I are more familiar with the North Hollywood bank robbery and whatever that was, 96. And that
96, being a big, February. Big actually, shootout. I believe that was February of 97.
Seven?
I think it was that maybe could 96, be. But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this just, you know, puts it to shame when we, so I'm very, anyway, I'm very excited to hear Al give a, kind of paint the picture of what that day was like, what that shooting was like from someone who was very involved in it and was there on the front line. But for today's purposes, Mark, talking about SLA and what they were about, the crimes they committed, a group founded in 1973, by Donald DeFries, an escaped convict, an African-American guy. And by the way, I think the name, correct me if I'm wrong, this whole name of Symbionese, the meaning they were trying to convey is it's a diverse group of everybody fighting for the people. It was Black, white, Hispanic, man, woman, and later on even, I think they had an Asian member, fighting for the people to kind of make sure the wealth was shared with everyone. Very anti-capitalist, anti-bougie might have been the term back then, right? In the 70s, anti-bougie group.
Anti-Western, anti-capitalist. Yep. And again, to go back that meaning, this you know, symbiotic, that everything working together as one. You know, really think about it, Bill, it's kind of the original diversity, equity, inclusion kind of mentality. I mean, when you think about it now, again, we're going to find out, not in a practical sense, not how it actually worked out, but this symbiotic, really kind of fantasy is what they were chasing.
Yeah. Hey, you know, speaking of fantasy, but before you jumped on today, Mark, I was speaking with Anthony and Vince, the producers of the show. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that this group, and I don't think, like I said earlier, it was never more than 12 people, that this, mm-hmm. SLA was never more than 12 people. To me, it struck me as almost a fantasy game. You make right. up a name for yourself. You make up a title. You talk about these crazy ideas and make, you know, make things seem so self-important. For example, we're collecting intelligence from around the country. And no, you're not actually. You're not doing that. This is like a fantasy game you're playing. Where you make up a title and a nickname for yourself and pretend you're fighting a revolution. But the other side of that, Mark, is there were real crimes they committed. There were real people they killed, banks that were robbed, bombings they attempted. So a very violent organization where women took a big part in the violence, again, to promote this communist or leftist ideology, right? And that is the definition of a terrorist group. At least the U.S. government's definition is there has to be some political ideology. And for sure, with this group, there was. Their motto, Mark, death to the fascist insect that preys upon the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So.
Yeah. And of course, Bill, when you think about this, when you look at the history going really back to the mid and late 60s, there are so many influences that did just that influenced this group. I mean, you're talking about Black Panthers.
Yep.
You're talking about the hippie culture. The same thing as far as this pushback against Western culture, culture, and so there were a lot of influences that went into what we're talking about here at SLA. There were so many radical groups at the time. And of course, we have to talk about the Vietnam War, the assassination mm-hmm. of JFK going back to 63 of 68, his brother RFK. So many things going on. And it was a terribly, terribly volatile period in American history, which, of course, it often breeds really the opportunities for these fringe groups to emerge and to flourish.
Right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, counterculture, when I see some of the things happening today in this country and I hear people talk about it and they're alarmed about it, I do feel like I have to remind people about the counterculture movement in the late 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. because I think it's very real. I think it was more extreme than it is now, in my opinion. When you're talking about bombings and kidnappings and bank robberies, I mean, I don't think we've seen that yet, unless it's gone under the radar here. But there's always been that counterculture movement. I just think it was kind of underground for a while, and in the past 5 years or so, it's reemerged. Mm-hmm. Am I on track with that, Mark?
Yeah, I think you are. I think that we were talking about this offline a couple of days ago, Bill, you and I, about these radical groups not being anything new. Maybe it's like you said earlier in the show here a few minutes ago, it can be cyclical. I think one of the things that, and this is my personal opinion, I think one of the things that truly is different, the groups, the influence that they may have, the impact, you're right, it's not nothing new. But I think one thing that may be new is really the way they're portrayed in the media. And it's just not a conspiracy theory, I don't think. I think that when you go back and look, and again, I'm old enough to remember this stuff. I'm old enough to remember that no matter what channel you tuned into, watch the news reporting of this stuff going on, there was certainly a scent or a slant, if you may, that this activity was wrong, period. There were different explanations to why it was happening, mm-hmm. but it was unacceptable, period. It was unacceptable. It was all about, how do we catch these people? How do we get to the bottom of this? How do we stop the behavior? Now there seems to be, there is a lot being said about, well, it's not as bad as it looks, or is there misinformation, or the quote unquote, mostly peaceful protest. These things would not have existed 50 years ago, not even, I think maybe even 20 years ago. So I think that's the difference. You're right. The groups are not different, but I think that how they are, for lack of a better word, coddled or maybe justified in the general media, I think that's different now.
The one thing I'll say to that, Mark, is I remember in one point doing the research for this, and there was a portion of the community that, I don't know if it would be correct to say they were sympathizers with groups like this, but what they said was, it's a shame that it's taken this to feed, this is when I'm going to get into this later, so maybe I'm ahead of myself, but it's a shame that it took tactics like this to feed the people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well,
when,
go ahead.
So, you know, it was almost like there was some justification of it. Now that's the populace. That's not the media.
Right. We'll get into that, because that's a very interesting point.
Way, you know, and who was the media, which brings us to Patty Hearst, right. And mm-hmm. her family, which is why she was targeted. But before we get there, Mark, mm-hmm. maybe the first kind of, headline crime this group committed was the murder of the school superintendent from Oakland, Marcus Foster. Actually, and what I didn't realize until, you know, going through this stuff, was that his deputy was also targeted and shot, not killed, but shot, I think.
Yeah.
Mark, cyanide tip bullets. Okay. I mean, you know, like that's a serious, strange thing, you know. And by the way, like, this is a group of college educated for the most part, or, you know, there were college dropouts. There were people with master's degree. Bill Harris, one of the members, mm-hmm. had a master's degree. So these were educated people that joined together, to kind of promote this cause, mm-hmm. and their targeting of the school superintendent, Marcus Foster, I think it kind of backfired on him.
Well,
but did you get what that was all about?
Well, it's weird. First of all, I mean, we'll cut the chase here, that they got the wrong person.
Yep.
And they targeted this man because you talk about history repeating itself, Bill, in a sense here, that he was targeted for his support of an ID system for Oakland students. I guess, in other words, making sure that the students who, you know, a way to track them, making mm-hmm. sure they who are who they say they are. And by the way, and maybe you said it, but he was black. Mm-hmm. Marcus Foster was black. And he wanted a secure ID system for the students in the Oakland School District. And I'm not exactly sure why this is so important to the people who murdered him, but they hated this idea. And then, of course, they mistakenly got the wrong guy here, because I think he wasn't the he didn't advocate for the ID system. Somebody else did, but that's why they killed him. It's a very, very bizarre thing. You talk about radicalization or radicals, and this is exactly right in a nutshell, that you want to murder somebody for them wanting to ID students in the school system. Is that worth killing somebody for? And if that is worth killing somebody for, then what else in this culture is worth killing somebody for? And that's what we'll get to later on.
That's a great point. And you're exactly right about that. He, at one point, I don't know, I think he supported it, this plan at one point, but then withdrew his support. And it was, I guess, for this group, an issue of the man exerting control, meaning government, not meaning
individual
Marcus Foster. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The government exerting control and requiring an identification and tracking students, or, you know, maybe allowing them on campus, not allowing them on campus, whatever. Mm-hmm. A strange reason, I thought, to in the scheme of what was going on at that time. Like, we're not talking about, you know, war protest or anything like that. We're talking about a guy who at one time supported student IDs and then withdrew his support, and he's killed over it, and his deputy is shot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take long. I think within 2 months, the police had identified two guys, mm-hmm. Russ Little and Joseph Ramiro, and they were charged with the murder, and, you know, they were put in jail. Interesting that, I don't know if you know anything about this, Mark, it looked like, listen, my understanding of the justice system in the state is you're in jail until you're convicted or plead guilty at that time. In other words, you wouldn't be in a state prison pre-trial.
No, you'd be in county jail. Now, right? Again,
and I want to say that there was a point before trial that they were actually moved to San Quentin. I could be wrong about that, but I thought that's, and just because of security concerns that were had, they felt like they.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say they felt like they couldn't house them safely, because of their association with this group, and, you know, the violence of the crime, the craziness of the crime, and they put them in state prison prior to their trial. I don't know if I have that correct. Maybe a listener that knows the story can chime in the comments on that.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's news to me.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, so born out of this, Mark, I think, is kind of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. You know, initially, I think that the thought was they target someone for kidnapping and they could do a swap. They could give the person back and get those two people out of jail, get their two brothers, comrades, as they say.
Comrades, yes.
Out of jail. So there just happened to be an article in the paper about, you know, high society section of the paper about Patty Hearst, 19-year-old, heir of the Hearst media empire. What, a $1 billion organization even back then, Mark?
Or something maybe like that. And not just the financial power, but really more importantly here, it was the political power that the Hearst family wielded, going back to Patty Hearst, I believe, grandfather, and incredibly powerful. In other words, this is a kingmaker and a ruiner of lives, quite frankly, this organization. So the whole point of that is that Patty Hearst represented really a huge portion of what SLA was supposedly fighting against, and that is free market and political influence and Western culture. I think she kind of epitomized that, at least by name.
So Mark, I'm curious, when you say, and I agree 100%, you say kingmaker and all these things, it almost makes me draw a parallel to what we see with some of the social media platforms today and their ability to shape the narrative of news stories and of political candidates, which I think there's been admissions of now, correct? I think you talked about that on your show, mm-hmm. your Leo Nation.
Yep.
Is that a part of this? So is what's going on today, in your opinion, with social media and with suppression of stories, promotion of other ideas and ideologies by the press, or can we say that that was a part of this, that the Hearst family with their media empire was involved in that or had the ability to push certain things, promote certain things, and that's also what made them a desirable target?
Yeah, in my opinion, there's no doubt that the mm-hmm. Hearst family, especially going back, it's the William Randolph Hearst, there's no doubt. I mean, it's documented, and quite frankly, I think he was proud of his ability to, have politicians really all at the highest levels in his pocket, and to influence the outcome of elections and legislation. Very, very powerful man, very powerful organization. So I think what we're seeing today, again, is a repeat of history. The difference is today, of course, I think it's the ability now, instead of talking about a printing press, the ability to hit a button to change an algorithm literally, in a matter of seconds can change the influence that these organizations have over billions of people's ability to search and to digest information. It's instant now. And that wasn't the case 70, 80 years ago. It wasn't the case 25 years ago. It wasn't the case 20 years ago. So that's the difference. The philosophy with these people, when I say these people, the people who are in the positions of quite frankly, manipulating the information that you and I see, that's nothing new. That goes back to the beginning of time when the ability to write it first came into existence. But now we're talking about the scope and the speed with which it can be done. That is a brand new thing.
Man, I agree with that 100%, Mark. And that is fascinating. That and that's kind of the thought that I had in doing the show was, these aren't new things, but these are things that have been exponentially magnified or multiplied because of the different technology and different media program out there today. So I don't know what your depth of knowledge is on the Hearst family, but were they right leaning? So if he controlled a media empire, would it be fair to say that media empire leaned right and kind of promoted the ideals of the right, and that also contributed to the daughter becoming a target?
Yeah, and I'm not an expert on the Hearst family by any stretch of the imagination. So I will plead ignorance as far as their political leanings. I guess we could, look right now where we're talking here on the show. But, I don't know if this was a, right-leaning organization, left-leaning organization. But I do know about the influence over decades that they had. And, of course, I don't care really which way they lean politically, is that I don't want any undue or unfair influence in really the ability for American people to select their leaders through the voting process and what information they have to read. I want it all out there. I want it all on a fair playing level, like everybody should. So, I don't know what it was.
Yeah. You know what, as I sit here and think about it, Mark, when I think about what transpired, and we'll go through it all, the assistance from the Carter administration and then the Clinton administration to the family later on. I think maybe they were probably on the other side, perhaps, but not communists. And maybe, maybe left is not left enough for what the SLA was looking for back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So, Mark, I want to talk a little bit about Patty Hearst and what was going on with her life, where she was at in life when she was kidnapped, because I think trying to understand her mind a little bit is going to help us theorize or have an intelligent discussion about whether this was brainwashing, whether this was someone acting on their own free will, or what her mindset was post-kidnapping, you know, two, three months post-kidnapping. She was living with a guy in 1974 named Steve Weed, right? Mm-hmm. Now, according to Steve, and this is something I saw him say in a clip, he had met her when he was a 23-year-old teacher and she was a 16-year-old student. And apparently they had, you know, started some type of relationship at that time. Inappropriate, right? Inappropriate. Right. Other teachers that worked with Weed had commented that they were aware that she spent the night at his residence, wherever that was. You know, her family, Patricia's family, pushed back, didn't think this was appropriate. And when she moved in with Steve Weed, and I don't know exactly when that was, but I'm going to assume 18, 19 years old, around that time, she moved in with Steve Weed and her family protested. And some accounts I've read, Mark, have described her at that time as someone at Berkeley undergoing a bit of a political awakening, perhaps having been sheltered in life up to that point, not being real involved in politics or perhaps not understanding politics. Now being at Berkeley, what would you call that? Almost like the lightning rod of left-leaning politics of that time period. Mm-hmm. And the relationship with Steve Weed, according to some accounts, starts to sour, but she stays with him because she doesn't want to make her parents right. This is a bit of a rebellious part of her at that time. Having this relationship, her parents didn't want her to have, agreeing to marry this guy. I don't think her parents were for that. Living with this guy, the way the whole relationship started, like these things, in my opinion, are very strong indicators of a rebellious nature in her. From your point of view, anything else like pre-kidnapping that you saw or that you took away from it that caused your opinion on her mindset later to lean one way or the other?
No, you know what? And I think that's the examples you gave, the background that you provided there, Bill. I think that is in itself really sufficient, at least to indicate that Patty Hearst was certainly vulnerable to the types of influences that we're talking about today. There's one point I want to make here about the mindset. Now, she was targeted, of course, for this kidnapping. We'll talk about this almost certainly because of her celebrity, because of the influence that her capture could bring, you know, through her family. But there's something else I think it's important to really appreciate is, aside from the fact that she was incredibly wealthy, that her family is incredibly powerful, incredibly influential, she's still an individual person. She was not the only person at UC Berkeley or where I went to school about 10 years later down the street at San Jose State University. Mm-hmm. She was not the only person on those campuses back in the early 1970s, late 1960s, or today, that became radicalized. Again, I understand that she's different because of her celebrity status, but she was one of countless thousands of people who do become and did become radicalized for whatever purposes, for whatever missions they were on, whatever philosophy that they had or have today. People become radicalized all the time. And so her experience is not unique. Her experience is different because of the value she brought to the SLA or to the people who would actually form the SLA. That is different. But clearly, someone who engages in this behavior, like I said, in other words, you're dating a professor, a teacher at your university, you're living with them, you're having a relationship with them, you already know that you've stepped way outside of the boundaries of what is acceptable. Either through policy or through law or through acceptable behavior as far as the culture is concerned. So she was certainly right for what happened to her later on.
Yeah. Yep. I don't think there's any question about that. And I mean, is it as simple, Mark, without getting ahead and kind of giving real specific theories, but what you bring up such a fascinating thing that a lot of people were radicalized at that time. Now, granted, they weren't kidnapped. So is there, where's the line, Mark, between brainwashing and coercion and simply being a teenager who becomes a product of their friends and or environment? Which,
yeah, I
this
think
sounds, you know, like, hey, the government agrees with me because we'll talk later about she got charged with some crime. So the government does agree with me. But could it be that simple that really it's not about brainwashing or coercion? It's about just being a product of your friends when you're growing up. And that's why as parents, we watch things like that.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I hate to use the word simple. In other words, you're asking the question and, you know, is it that simple? I'll use this word. I think it's that explainable, Bill. Mm,
yeah.
I do think it's that explainable. I'll give you another example. And you know, I may get the name right. It's either Patricia Krenwinkel or was it...
The other founder of the group?
No. I'm talking about a whole different thing, the Charles Manson group.
Okay.
And I apologize. I could pull it up here. But one of the women... with the Charles Manson family, quote unquote, called the Manson family. One of the women who was later convicted of some of the murders, Tate's, the LaBiancas, she was a homecoming queen at her high school, also kind of down the street from where I grew up. And she was a homecoming queen. She came from a terribly middle-class family. There was nothing extraordinary one way or about the family. It seemed very stable. There was never anything about a bad relationship with the parents, things like this. But she fell into, I'll use that phrase, maybe liberally here. She fell into drugs and she fell into really the counterculture of the hippies in the 1960s. She meets Charles Manson. She ends up murdering multiple people and is still in prison today. Mm. And so, you know, is it that simple? Again, you and I are not psychologists. It's very difficult to, even if we were, to get into the mind of someone from afar without examining them. And again, neither of us are those types of professionals. But I think it's explainable that some people, for whatever reasons, they are, use the word vulnerable, or they are open to, they are accepting
susceptible.
Of. Susceptible, it's a great, great word. They're susceptible to these influences. They are susceptible to these influences. So the phrase brainwashed, again, there's an actual clinical definition of brainwashing, but I think certainly there's a practical definition, and that's simply it's being influenced by someone or some group over time to make you engage in certain behavior that you may not have otherwise engaged in without that influence. So when you look at a standalone serial killer, you pick any number of them, they weren't brainwashed. In other words, they were born that way to create themselves, whatever it was. But you have other people who probably would not have engaged in certain behavior had they not been exposed to a certain group or a certain individual or maybe even, you know, substances, things like this. This is what takes them down that road. They're on that teeter-totter, and all they need is a little bit of push, and then off they go. And I think that's what we're talking about here with Patty Hearst.
Yep. I think that's a great assessment of what was going on in her mind when this thing started. A great assessment. So I don't know when this is, Mark. February 4th, 74, a guy named Bill Harris, one of the SLA members, who has a master's degree, by the way. I forget what it was in.
I
don't know.
Don't know.
Yeah, don't remember. But, you know, an educated guy, him and a couple others break into the pad where she's living in Berkeley with Steve Weed. They rough up Steve Weed, beat him up, kidnap her, throw her in the trunk of a car, you know, outside and drive her away and she's gone. And we've just seen the kidnapping of the daughter of one of the wealthiest families, one of the most influential families in the United States, and they immediately claim credit for it, the SLA does, and they speak of it like it's a military operation, that she's going to be held as a prisoner of war under the Geneva Convention. She'll be treated in accordance with the Geneva Convention. And I know this is where there's a little bit of, I guess, disagreement or conflict on different sides of the story, like depending on who's telling the story. She says kept in a closet for a long time. It's 3x5 foot closet or something like that, blindfolded. Claims she was raped repeatedly. Bill Harris says the rapes never took place, that she actually developed a relationship with one of the other SLA members. And when he was killed later, there is a recording of her talking about her love for this SLA member that was killed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, so in those early days, what did you take away from those early days of the kidnapping? I mean, just when I guess all of America at that time is thinking, you know, she's basically a prisoner of war, a prisoner of this war against capitalism.
Yeah, I was 11 years old or so, you know, when this happened. And I remember it well enough. Of course, my parents talking about it from the news every day, obviously, for weeks with the initial after the initial kidnapping. And of course, there was no reason at the time for anybody who wasn't in the know to think anything other than what it appeared to be, a kidnapping. Mm-hmm. They kidnap her for ransom. I mean, in other words, it's a reasonable assumption. There'd be no reason to assume anything different without without information. And that's, of course, later on. Well, we get more facts, and you and I will talk about that later on in the show. And forgive my coughing, ladies and gentlemen. I got a little bit of a cold I'm working on right now. But so there was nothing extraordinary about it other than, of course, the terror. The idea of someone's 19-year-old, you know, child being kidnapped and being held for ransom. Now, you asked Bill about, you know, the complete circumstances here, you know, what's going through everybody's mind. And you're talking about how they were saying, hey, we're going to hold her and, you know, under the terms of the Geneva Convention. I mean, these people, it shows really how completely untethered from reality they are. For example, right after she was kidnapped, they send what they called in quote a communique. That's how they sent it. They sent a communique to a radio station in Berkeley about the kidnapping. The SLA did. They sent a communique to the kidnapping, but there are no ransom demands. They just sent the information, we have her, blah, 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 blah. Okay. And now what? In other words, there doesn't seem to be any forethought, any end game, Bill. Thank you for kind of get me on track here. There doesn't seem to be any purpose, any end game, not anything that can be deciphered. So it really indicates from the beginning how chaotic these people are.
That's a great deal. That kind of shows like what I said earlier about how this was almost like a fantasy game that that young adults were playing, not realizing that it had real world consequences. You know, it was like they were playing a video game, but they were doing it in real life.
Yep.
So unique case, because I don't know, this is probably the first or one of the first times where we saw such real-time live media coverage of an event. The media was now it's commonplace, right? The media camps outside someone's house.
Yeah.
I mean, this was one of the first times that happened, you know, at least according to the reports that I read, and someone from the Hearst family would come out and make a statement once in a while, and they would play the tapes that were being sent. They would read the communiques, as you mentioned. And really, you know, at some point in time, though, Mark, they talked about the desire to do a prisoner swap. The two people that were in jail for the murder of Marcus Foster, getting them released and trading them for Patty Hearst. But I think that was like not even, you know, it was just like a no. You know, the government just said no to that. And that went away. And then it became, if I'm not mistaken, they got the idea that they should use this as leverage to feed the underprivileged, feed the homeless. And they demanded some really high dollar amount of food. I don't know if you remember exactly what it was. What was ultimately spent.
I think it was $6 million.
Yeah. So something like that. And they demanded that the public be fed with these programs. And again, this is what I alluded to earlier, where there were people in the community that said, oh, it's a shame that it took a group like this to get the poor people fed. But the family really kind of did what they were told, right?
Yes, they did. Well, initially, her father said that it just couldn't be done. It was impossible. In other words, that it was, the money wasn't available. They couldn't do it. And it just wasn't feasible. So then they come back, if I remember correctly, they come back with a counter offer or counter demand. I'm sorry. The SLA does back with Hearst and goes back and forth. And eventually he agrees to, it was, I think, $2 million over 12 months to feed 100,000 people. And by the way, they called it the People in Need, the PIN distribution program. So he agrees to feed 100,000 people over 12 months for about $2 million. Now, Bill, I've got to chime in here because a minute ago you said that originally they were demanding a prisoner swaps that for the two criminals who killed Marcus Foster from the school district and basically the state of California said that's not going to happen. Period. Right. So what happened to Patty Hearst? What were the repercussions? None, as far as we know, nothing happened. They just put their foot down and said, no, we're not gonna give you these murderers in exchange for Patty Hearst or anybody else. Not gonna happen. And nothing detrimental, as far as we know, ever happened to Patty Hearst or anybody else. But when they got to this food program, again, this goes back to the chaotic minds, these people, the no end game, as you said so perfectly a few minutes ago, the lack of any strategic planning, the lack of any defined outcome, nothing. Mm-hmm. Okay, now what do we do? Okay, well, let's feed the poor. Let's make Hearst feed the poor. Do you know who said that this was a horrible idea? When Hearst gave in and started giving the money for it, the then governor, Ronald Reagan, said this is a horrible idea. Basically, you're aiding and abetting a criminal act if you give in to their demands. Now, this is really important because Reagan, the two-term governor of California, he went through as governor. He was dealing with these protests on UC Berkeley and San Jose State, where I went, all these college campuses, and about the Vietnam protests and other protests. And he started putting people in jail. He called up the National Guard, the California Highway Patrol, my old friends, and just said, we're not going to put up with it. It's not acceptable that you can shut down a university or you can keep people, you know, held hostage in their offices. It's not acceptable. We're not going to negotiate. We're not going to negotiate because you're engaged in criminal behavior. That was Ronald Reagan's point of view. And it's exemplified in what you said about when they wanted the prisoner swap. They said, no, we're not going to do it. But the private sector, Mr. Hearst, Patty's father, can do whatever he wants to. There's no control over that. Right. And I think that Reagan was right when he said, if you start giving into these demands about feeding people, blah, 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 all you're going to do is encourage more of this behavior, i.e. kidnapping and other criminal behavior.
And Mark, I saw a clip which goes to exactly what you're saying. And it was the attorney general of the state of California at the time. I don't remember who it was. I don't remember who the AG was at that time. But he came out and said, because to take one step back, these food giveaways devolved into riots at one point. As they tried to give out the food, a riot ensued, and it just got really ugly and turned into a big mess. And, you know, the state's kind of left to clean up the mess. And the attorney general came out and said, if you're involved in this, even if you're distributing the food, we will prosecute you because it's, you know, in furtherance of this kidnapping crime. It's extortion is what it is. It's the crime of extortion. And that kind of, my understanding was that kind of put this food giveaway program to bed after they said that. I don't know that it continued, or if it was the Hearst family just saying, hey, we don't have the money, we can't do it anymore, or whatever it was. But you're exactly right. They said they were going to prosecute people for being part of this extortion, you know, just for giving the food away or whatever. April 15th, 1974, the Hibernia Bank at 22nd and Noriega in San Francisco. The SLA does a bank robbery there. You know, some reports are, Mark, that they choose this bank for the specific reason that they know there are cameras in it. Don't know if this is accurate. I don't really know at that time if all banks had cameras, if it was kind of a new thing in 1974 to have CCTV or recordings of the inside of the bank. But the famous, famous video, Patty Hearst with a rifle in the lobby of the bank, and they even sent the film out to have lip readers read it and see what she was saying. Mm-hmm. They robbed the bank. They get away with $10,000. She releases, Patty Hearst releases a tape recording at some point after that, or I should say the SLA releases a recording of her saying that basically she's a willing participant. Another tape recording, this isn't brainwashing. I haven't been brainwashed. I'm down for the cause. That bank robbery that took place there in San Francisco, your theory or your opinion on, because, hey, you know, on her side of it or on the other side of it, they said she was forced to do it. There was always a rifle pointed at her. She was told if she did anything that stepped out of line, she would be killed. Do you think willing participant in that robbery, Mark, based on what you saw in the video and what you've learned about this case?
Yeah, years ago, and I'm talking about years ago, I'm talking 30, 40 years ago, I was somewhat ambivalent about which way it went. There's no doubt in my mind today as we sit here and speak, Bill, that she was a willing, enthusiastic participant in this. And, you know, the idea that if you are captive, if you are in fear of your life, but now you have a shotgun in your hand, and I'm assuming that it was operative. I guess if the shotgun, I mean, I guess if she were being held captive, maybe they give her a phony gun. I don't know. Mm-hmm. In other words, we can come up with all these theories.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea, when you look at that tape, and again, I remember that because I'm old enough to remember watching this tape over and over and over and over. There were just too many opportunities for her to run, to listen. If you and I were in that situation, you would say, I'm done with this. They can shoot at me. I'm going to run out that door. I'm going to make a left turn when they go right to the car. I'm getting out of here. There was nothing like that. And then you couple that with the statements that came later on tape from her about her own family, about her former fiance, Stephen Weed, how she, you know, again, can you put a gun to someone's head and make them make these tape recordings? Of course you can. But when you start putting the pieces of the puzzle together over time, there's simply nothing that indicates that she was not a willing and enthusiastic participant in all this. And you couple that with earlier years when she's having a relationship with her professor, things like this. Mm-hmm. To me, it points in one direction that she was down for the cause, like you said a minute ago, and she participated in this stuff because she wanted to.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree with that. And again, like you, I do remember these videos or still pictures that they took from the videos being released back in the 70s. And, you know, for a number of years thinking, wow, I wonder, you know, what is that all about? Was she forced or, man, I think 100% now she was down for it and she became one of them. And it was just, you know, technically, is it brainwashing? I don't know. Or technically, is it just like all the other kids that were at Berkeley that were radicalized and, you know, protesting on campus?
Yeah.
You know, what's the difference there?
Yeah, what is the only difference is the level of activity, mm-hmm. legal or otherwise, that you engage in a particular cause, and many people cross the boundary of legality she's one of them. But like you said, you know, what does brainwashing really mean? It's just it's accepting, giving in to, being open to a different way of thinking, and then eventually adopting that way of thinking and that philosophy, and then engaging in the activity that supports it. That's what it means to me. Again, yep. I'm not a psychologist, psychiatrist. I don't know anything about the brain, but I do know about activity and behavior.
Yep. I think you're right on. So after that robbery, the group made the decision to get out of San Francisco, right? That they headed south for LA. And interesting that by all accounts, that was a major mistake that they made. And the description from some of the old timers that were around when this happened, and when I say old timers, I don't really mean necessarily people in law enforcement, but even the reporters from San Francisco said that it was a flawed decision when they went to LA because they thought the LA police would be like the San Francisco police. And things turned out a little bit different, right? And as I mentioned at the opening, that show will be out next week. We'll interview one of the police officers who was, on the ground dealing with the SLA in this crazy shootout in South LA. But to lead up to that, the group comes down to LA in May, right? So in May, they're in LA. They go to a sporting goods store in Inglewood, California. And Inglewood's what? Kind of between LAX, between the airport and the ocean, and South LA. So an incorporated city just kind of west of the downtown area. I don't know if that's a
good... Southwest.
Okay. Uh-huh. And they go to a sporting goods store called Mel's Sporting Goods, and this is Emily Harris and Bill Harris, husband and wife, members of SLA. They, whatever supplies they said they needed or whatever, they apparently attempted to shoplift from the store. Now, while they're in the store, Patty Hearst is in a van across the street with the keys by herself. So, Mark, she could have left at any time.
And by the way, with a gun.
With a gun, yeah. With a gun. She could have left at any time. And this, and then while we're on this point, there was also an opportunity. Once time she contracted poison oak. She contracted poison oak at some point and went to the hospital for treatment by herself. Could have escaped then. There was another time she was hiking and she was in some real remote area and some rangers actually, park rangers actually came upon her and got her pointed in the right direction. And my understanding is that was another time when she could have easily escaped, quote, captivity, if she was in fact, kidnapped. The point on all these things, and probably the sporting goods store is the best example.
Yeah.
Like you said, she's in a van with the keys, with a gun, by herself. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity is 100% there for her to flee, turn herself in, and this whole thing's over. She sees Emily Harris and Bill Harris tackled outside the store or confronted, whatever the case is. And what does she do, Mark? Does she flee? Does she save herself? Does she turn herself in? What happens?
She unloads, she fires, I'm not sure what kind of weapon it was, but 30 caliber bullets into the storefront. And in order to provide cover and distraction for the Harris, couple to escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
that kind of says it all, right?
It says it all right there. I mean, nothing's more indicative. And because you and I were, than the fact that she was a willing participant. And you and I both, Bill, had, obviously separately years ago, come to the conclusion, just based on things before this, before the sporting good caper, that she's most likely a willing participant, like you said, though. But this says it all right here.
Yeah. So the three of them, Emily Harris, Bill Harris, and Patty Hearst, they flee to Anaheim, Disneyland, a city just south of Los Angeles in Orange County. They flee down there. They don't go spend, they don't go back to the safe house that the group has. So this kind of brings us up to the point where there's a huge confrontation between the SLA and LAPD in Los Angeles. And again, the two Harrises and Hearst aren't at that confrontation. That confrontation we will talk about next week with Al Preciado, an LAPD officer who was there, who was involved in it firsthand. I think he fired over 500 rounds himself, Mark, in this gun battle. That's how intense this firefight was. But skipping that, I mean, to talk about briefly the SLA after that shootout, you know, some of the things that they did after that shootout. Hearst and Harris were on the run. They went to the East Coast for a while. They came back to Los Angeles at one point and they robbed another bank. And I do want to talk about that. It was 1975. It was in Carmichael. And the reason I want to talk about that bank robbery is because someone was killed at this bank robbery.
And just for the audience, so Carmichael's back in Northern California, their old stomping grounds. In other words, so not down in LA where this big shootout happened.
Right. Right. They hit out in the East Coast for a while, came back to Northern California. Mark, there was support for them in the Berkeley community, even after, you know, after this crazy shootout in LA, and that almost caused some people to come out and support them, that they, and again, we'll talk about that next week, that they, you know, most of the SLA members were killed in that shootout in LA, mm-hmm. but people in Northern California, let's call it the Berkeley crowd, came out in support of the SLA because they had, you know, been decimated by that shootout. So they had kind of these public memorials for them. They recruited new members. And this is, you know, that was, some of those people were involved in this Carmichael bank robbery in April 75. So the reason I wanted to bring this one up, a 42-year-old mother of four is murdered in the bank, Myra Opsahl. Mark, it doesn't get any more innocent than a 42-year-old mother of four who's depositing church receipts in the bank, murdered by this terrorist organization. You know, I mean, you know, like you said that earlier, like, what is the, is it really just like self-enrichment, or they just need money and they're robbing banks now to fund themselves? And there's this dream of revolution overthrowing the government is BS, and or what?
Well, I just think at some point, Bill, again, groups like this, it's because, again, I keep going back to it because the phrase he uses is perfect. When there's no end game, then there is no explanation as to why they do these things. It becomes this self-perpetuating, continuous crime spree. And you don't have to look at just the SLA. I mean, you can look at any number of groups or individuals, but especially groups, I think we're talking about right now with these different philosophies, these mindsets, is that, well, we're just going to keep going from, you know, place to place, so to speak, until we get enough momentum, we get enough additional members, we create enough havoc, we influence the culture, the politics, the government enough, we can actually start making change. But they don't have any specific strategy about how that's going to work. It's just, we have to keep breeding, so to speak, until this change comes to us. And so that's what we're seeing here. And like I said, it results in the murder of this woman depositing check receipts in the bank. But this is what happens. This is the radicalization. To go back, we said a minute ago about people showing support and memorials out for the people, you know, these SLA members who were killed in South Los Angeles. It goes back again, Bill, to what is brainwashing? How do you get to the point where you are memorializing, you are supporting people who were killed, who we know for a fact kidnapped? Yep. Kidnapped Patty Hearst, and whether or not she was a willing participant from that point on, have all engaged in criminal behavior, and now you're memorializing them after they're killed by law enforcement. This too is a level, in my opinion, of brainwashing, when you have completely become untethered to any sense of right or wrong when you are, you know, lifting up these people who've committed, you know, numerous crimes, including murder, this is frightening. And again, it's not dissimilar from what we're seeing today.
Yeah, and this bank robbery where the woman was killed, important to talk about this one for two reasons. One is Patty Hearst was there and allegedly a getaway car driver. And the second person who was there, Sarah Jane Olson, that wasn't her name at the time, but let's use the name Sarah Jane Olson. She changed her name to that. She kicked a pregnant woman in the abdomen and in this bank robbery, and that woman had a miscarriage, right? Sarah Jane Olson went on to be involved in the attempted bombings of two police cars later in Los Angeles. Pretty well-known case here in LA, I would say. Mm-hmm. She was charged in these bombings and she went on the run, Mark, and she disappeared for 25 years. Yeah. And this was an educated woman. I don't know what her level of education was, but she was college educated, on the run. No one saw her. In 99, I think, two episodes of America's Most Wanted air, and they target her, and she's caught in June of 99. Mm-hmm. She's caught in June 99 after 25 years on the run. And in 2001, she pled guilty, and, you know, that turned into a whole mess because this was right after 9/11, right? Right after September 11, 2001. The next month, according to her, she says, "I don't know. I was there. I'm accused of being involved in a bombing. I have to plead guilty because I'm just going to get railroaded if I don't." She pleads guilty. Right after pleading guilty, she goes out and tells the media, "I didn't do it. I just pled guilty because I would have been railroaded otherwise." Judge Fidler, who as I told you the other day, I had dealings with, he was. Yeah. You know, a very fair, very intelligent judge. He has her come back into court and basically says, "Were you lying then or are you lying now?" You know, and she tried to change her plea and he would not accept the plea change. Mm-hmm. So she ends up doing time. I don't know, Mark. I think, you know, there's a couple interesting things, I guess, as we wrap it up, like quotes I heard about this case. This is an interesting one. And I do want to talk about what Patty Hearst ended up, you know, the criminal cases on her, where they ended up. But a quote from the LA Times: "For anxious parents who worried that Vietnam era counterculture might swallow their children, the heiress with the M1 seemed the nightmare embodiment of how far rebellion might go." And that kind of goes to what we were saying at the opening, where this radicalization that was taking place on college campuses, how far could it go? How far could it go? And we saw in this case, the second thing was this is a profile that someone created of Patty Hearst: "A rich kid lacked meaning and or purpose in life, found it in the SLA. She had found a warped sense of freedom from parental control." So she had this life of privilege, affluence, opportunity, but maybe felt like she was not in control of it. Everything was not preordained, but all her future was, you know, dictated by her, and she rebelled and wanted to do something to take control. And it almost goes back to something a profile I read when I first started looking at this case, which was like, you know, you're kidnapped, if you're being forced to do things that you don't want to do, you just simply change your mindset. And if you want to do them, then you're no longer being forced to do them, and it's your own free will. And you know, some experts would say that's what was going on with Patty Hearst. So anyway, Mark, just to talk about where she ended up, she was caught in 75 and charged with the Hibernia bank robbery. That was the first bank robbery that we talked about, the famous one where she's on camera with the M1. When she was booked on that case, they asked her occupation.
Yeah.
And she proudly said, "Urban guerrilla."
Yeah.
That was what she said as her application. Now, after meeting with her defense team, her story quickly changed, and it became one of brainwashing, coercive persuasion, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that I guess her story changed to whatever was kind of convenient. And I've heard other experts say that all her decisions were actually very rational. She always did what was in her best interest at that moment. You know, I don't know. And Mark, what are your takeaways from the whole thing?
Well, my takeaway from this, it's an illustration, Bill, about the potential for human nature. I am not a believer that humans are peaceful or kind by nature. I'm just not. I think that without societal guidelines, without clear, fair, consistent, and immediate repercussions, that, you know, people will devolve into their lowest being. And I know it sounds maybe, you know, pretty philosophical and out there, but I believe this to my core, that there is a reason that we have a term functional society, you know, as opposed to anarchy, because I just think that at our core, at our base, people are capable of the most heinous behavior. And this is why when Reagan said, and the attorney general that you pointed out, I'm glad that you did, I wasn't aware of that, that, you know, this behavior will not be acceptable. If you are taking part in distributing this food, that you're going to be arrested for aiding and abetting a crime. That is what has to happen in order not to see the really the chaotic nature that I think that individuals can be capable of. So, you know, my takeaway from it in a nutshell, which is too late for that, is that she did what she wanted to do because she did not feel the effects of any societal guidelines, just like the rest of those people in that organization, SLA, just like the Black Panthers who committed crimes, just like Charles Manson, all the people that followed him. This is what happens when people are not held accountable and not taken off the street, quite frankly, and not made examples of, that if you do things to harm people in society, we'll take you out of society. That's what happened.
Great point. So to that end, Hearst was sentenced to 7 years for the Hibernia bank robbery. She ended up doing 20, and you know, the government put on the case that she was a willing participant, and you know, she was convicted, sentenced to 7 years. She did 22 months, and Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence. And again, I would say that was the gift of affluence and influence, right? That, you know, you're talking about pretty serious federal crime, armed bank robbery, where shots were fired. No one was killed in that Hibernia bank robbery, but at least two shots were fired by people that committed the robbery. She got 22 months. Clinton comes into office, and Clinton ends up giving her a full pardon. And what exactly does that mean, Mark? Does that mean it comes off her criminal record, like the conviction disappears?
Or? Yeah, the conviction disappears.
Yeah. So again, the gift of affluence and influence.
Yes.
The media, you know, media magnate's daughter gets her sentence commuted, and then the case made to go away. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything else to cover on that.
It's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating story. And again, I think that maybe one day down the road, we should have a, you know, we could have a psychologist on the show to talk about how these things happen, you know, what the influences actually look like and how people go about manipulating other people, because it's this all happened. I have no doubt that she was manipulated, but my God, we're all manipulated to one point or another in life. And most of us put the brakes on and say, oh, no, I'm not going that far. That's not going to happen. You know, why people actually go this far, it is a fascinating question, and one I certainly can't answer, but we know it's a fact. They do it. It happens all the time. We have people today that a year ago had never engaged in any criminal behavior at all, zero. And now that it's happened again at Columbia University. They are, you know, they're protesting illegally. You know, last year they were holding administrators hostage They are destroying public and private property. And before that, they had never probably had a speeding ticket, you know, so to speak. How do you go from that to engaging in clearly felonious behavior openly? It's a really interesting question about how people cross these lines and engage in behavior.
Yeah. And the only thing I'll add to the whole talk is the only person still in prison in this group is Romero, one of the two that was convicted in the shooting of Marcus Foster. That's it. Everyone else did their time, got out. And even Sarah Jane Olson, who was on the run for 25 years, then got charged with bombings, got charged with a bank robbery where someone was murdered. Even her daughter, when asked about how she felt that, you know, her mom was this person and had this past, she said it was Berkeley. She wasn't a terrorist. She was an urban guerrilla.
Boy, oh boy.
Yeah. So folks, join us next week. We will talk with Al Preciado, and he will give a detailed eyewitness account of the massive shooting with the SLA in downtown, or not downtown, but South Los Angeles, a shooting that kind of probably has an impact on law enforcement tactics today, a discussion about SWAT team in the early days, and a discussion about how the Los Angeles Police Department was a little bit different than the San Francisco Police Department at that time, and why it was probably a bad decision for the SLA to come to LA and try to set up camp. So join us next week. Chief, thank you as always. Pretty fascinating discussion, and we'll see everyone soon.